Another debate is shaping up over whether this country should prepare for a war in cyberspace. On one side, the Pentagon, with a forthcoming plan that will deal head-on with cyber war issues. On the other side, the White House coordinator for cybersecurity, who says the prospect of cyber war is remote. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
No one can say Howard Schmidt is unprepared to serve as President Obama's cybersecurity coordinator. He was a munitions expert in the Air Force. As a police officer, he pioneered the use of computer databases for crime solving. He was a computer forensics expert for the FBI and the top security officer at Microsoft and eBay. He brings 40 years of experience to his White House cyber position, and he does not see a lot that's new in the way a hacker these days works his way into a computer network.
Ultimately, you get to the point where you basically own the computer system. That's a very, very standard method of operation that people use and have used for 20-some-odd years of getting into the systems.
Standard operating procedure. But other security experts say the cyber threats out there these days are unprecedented. Consider the Pentagon view. Here's Deputy Defense Secretary William Lynn speaking about the cyber war threat at a conference in February organized by the cybersecurity company RSA.
The most dangerous cyber threat is destruction, where cyber tools are used to cause actual physical damage. This development, which marks a strategic shift in the cyber threat, is only just emerging.
If a cyber weapon were used to blow up a pipeline or a power grid, there would have to be a decision about how to respond and who would give the order. But Howard Schmidt is not that focused on cyber war scenarios. He doesn't even use the term. What we're seeing now, he says, is still crime and espionage. Talking about cyber war, he says, is a diversion from the real cybersecurity challenges and a mischaracterization of current threats.
My father was in a war. My son's been in a war. I've been in a war. And this is not what we're going through right now.
This debate may seem academic, but U.S. cyber policy is at stake. One senior military official who deals exclusively with cyber issues says it's, quote, the height of naivete, unquote, to think it's not necessary to prepare for someone using a cyber weapon on a power grid. And Deputy Defense Secretary Lynn came close to saying that in February.
Of course, it is possible that destructive cyber attacks will never be launched. Regrettably, however, few weapons in the history of warfare, once created, have gone unused.
Developing a cyber war defense, Lynn said, will be a key goal of the Pentagon's new cyber strategy due to be introduced later this month. But first, there has to be a resolution of any dispute within the administration over how much emphasis to put on cyber war scenarios. At the White House, Howard Schmidt won't say he's gotten any pushback from the Pentagon for his refusal to use the term cyber war, though there have been, he says, conversations about the issue. In fact, disputes such as this often reflect competing bureaucratic interests. Stuart Baker was Assistant Secretary for Policy at the Homeland Security Department in the last administration. Behind the cyber definition question, he says, are long-standing departmental rivalries.
This is a semantic issue that is really a proxy for a whole bunch of turf issues. Who's in charge? Who's going to make policy? Who's going to be taking the initiative?
If the cyber challenge is viewed from a warfighting perspective, the Pentagon would be in charge. But an emphasis on meeting the cyber war threat could mean businesses have to deal with more expensive security requirements. As the White House cybersecurity coordinator, Howard Schmidt has to consider all those factors and not just scare people.
When the president said this is an important issue, it was said about fixing the issue, not raising alarms, because there's plenty of people out there to raise alarms. It's how do we look at a rational way to move forward that's good for the economy, that's good for national security, that's good for public safety, without a lot of FUD hype out there.
Of course, too much disagreement over the nature of the cyber threat and how to respond could lead to policy stalemates or leave key questions unanswered during what everyone agrees is a critical time. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Sony has been a top scorer in the gaming world, so many eyes were on the corporation this week at E3. That's the Electronic Entertainment Expo in Los Angeles. Those are the three E's. The company's had a rough couple of years, recently suffering from the Japanese earthquake and tsunami, and then a major security breach. But as NPR's Nina Gregory reports, the game's not over yet.
From the Walkman to the CD, Sony has contributed to or invented some of the most significant consumer electronics in the world. The company also makes movies and the cameras that make movies and how you watch them at home. They also make video games. But all that glory feels like it's fading. Recently, Sony has had some bad luck. So bad, it had to open its E3 press conference with an apology.
And I want to apologize both personally and on behalf of the company for any anxiety that we've caused you.
That's Jack Tretton. He heads Sony's U.S. Computer Entertainment Division. He's talking about recent cyber attacks on the company's PlayStation Network that compromised 77 million customer accounts and took the network down for weeks. Though analysts have criticized Sony for taking too long to respond, gamers think Sony did a fine job.
When I hear the name Sony, I think anything that's brand Sony is good. It's quality.
They handled this very, very well. They let people know what was going on, how they're doing, what they're doing to recover from this, and it's just amazing.
That was gamers Ricardo Hernandez and Antonio Williams at E3. Other gamers agree. 90% of those on the PlayStation Network before the hack are back online playing games. The president of Sony Computer Entertainment is Kazuo Hirai, or Kaz as he's known. He says the security breach was an alarming lesson.
I think it's really a wake-up call for corporations around the world that deal in personal information about the importance of being vigilant.
Hirai's response is being watched closely because Sony's CEO, Sir Howard Stringer, has tapped him as a possible successor. Jack Plunkett is an industry analyst.
Kaz is in charge of 2/3 of the revenue units of the company and the side of the company that Sony is really betting the future on.
And that's a bet Sony needs to win. Last month, the company posted its worst annual loss since 1995. That's partly due to the hacking, the earthquake, and the tsunami. Again, Jack Plunkett.
They need to get some of that excitement back into their televisions, their stereos, their basic entertainment devices where, frankly, they've been outmaneuvered by a lot of other companies.
Another thing Sony could do is return to its roots. John Nathan wrote Sony, A Private Life. He explains what made the company successful in the first place.
The salient fact is that everybody in Sony, which was really run as a kind of family business long after it entered the multi-billion dollar gross mark, was a connection of interpersonal relationships in which everyone was directly, in one way or another, connected to the founders. The engineers lived to see them smile.
Those founders are Akio Morita and Masaru Ibuka. Their legacy still lives at Sony, says the next possible leader, Kaz Hirai.
Mr. Morita had always talked about a combination of hardware and software, and obviously that's in the heart of everything that we do today. But perhaps the only difference being that today it's not only just hardware and content, but it's also network and services.
And perhaps this understanding of hardware and software and the network is why Hirai is at the top of the list to be the company's next CEO. Now, if only he can keep those networks secure, perhaps he might have a new job. Nina Gregory, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. It seems to keep happening. Citigroup is the latest victim in a string of attacks by hackers on major corporations, including Google and Sony. Today, Citigroup alerted customers that it recently discovered what it calls unauthorized access to some of the customers' accounts. NPR's Nina Gregory reports that the security breach was limited, but it is significant.
Just 1%, or about 210,000 Citi North America bank card customer accounts were compromised, the bank says. In a statement it emailed today, Citi said names, account numbers, and contact information were, quote, viewed. Social security numbers, birth dates, and those little security numbers on the back of your credit card were not. Even if the scope of the snooping was limited, this latest data breach is part of a larger trend. That's according to Juris Evers, a security expert at McAfee, a cybersecurity company here in California.
10 years ago, cyber attacks were all about, you know, teenagers looking for notoriety, basically putting the digital equivalent of graffiti on people's websites. Today, we really see cyber criminals go after money, and they're going after where the money is. And, you know, where is money and where is financial information? Well, it's at banks, you know, it's at the IRS, it's at online stores, and any place where you might put in your credit card number or your personal information.
These types of attacks are enough of a threat that FBI Director Robert Mueller brought them up at his reconfirmation hearing at the Senate yesterday. Preventing attacks like the recent one on Google, Mueller said, is an FBI priority, right along with national security, terrorism, and espionage.
These attacks threaten to undermine the integrity of the internet and to victimize the businesses and people who rely on it.
Cybersecurity expert Evers agrees and explains the scope of the threat of cyber attacks.
Some of the major concern these days is about the security of critical infrastructure systems. So there are legitimate concerns about whether somebody, an adversary from even outside of the United States, could impact our power generation, for example, or the financial markets through a cyber attack.
For now, though, security experts say while banks need to be vigilant about their security, so too do bank customers. So says Jerry Egan, a security expert at Symantec.
If we ourselves as individuals don't take precautions about, you know, having security software, for example, installed on our machine at home, perhaps we're leaving ourselves open to compromise. Similarly, organizations want to open themselves up to allow their customers to do business with them, but they have to be aware of the risks associated with that and take appropriate measures.
So if you plan to bank or pay bills or shop online, it's the same message as always. Have antivirus software. Make sure your passwords are strong and safely store them somewhere, like on a piece of paper in your wallet. And for consumers who have actually had money stolen from them as a result of a data breach like Citi's, the money is recoverable, though the time spent trying to get it back is not. Nina Gregory, NPR News.
Those intent on hacking into big systems will soon have a big new target. This week, Apple announced its iCloud service that stores massive amounts of content, much like a giant storage system in the sky. iCloud users will be able to wirelessly access their music, photos, email, calendar, and all kinds of other content on several devices. It's meant to eliminate the need to sync phones, computers, laptops, and tablets. It's all about convenience. But is it safe? The iCloud announcement was met with both applause and skepticism due to security concerns. And to wade through some of those questions, we're joined by Brian Cooley. He's an editor-at-large with the online tech magazine CNET. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Michelle.
First, a quick explanation of the iCloud system, how it works, and why there are such strong security concerns.
Well, first off, the cloud term is this idea that we use the internet as part of or an extension of our computers. So our data can live on the internet just like it used to live on our hard drive. You access it over the internet as opposed to going to a folder on your desktop. So as I'm describing this, you can kind of see how your machine or your portable, your iPhone, whatever it is, suddenly is sort of leaking out or spreading out across the internet like this sheen of technology, but it's your stuff. So you now have a broader footprint out there that potentially hackers could go after.
I'm wondering about how people might try to access the data. Is the vulnerability based on how the content is stored or how it is delivered? Do people try to access the data while it is in transit, when people try to download their photos or their email?
Yeah, two major layers you're pointing out here. One is the cloud servers that Apple runs. They built this huge data center in North Carolina, an enormous building full of computers. And to form an attack that goes after those computers, finds my information, and pulls a copy of it to do whatever that hacker wants to do to me, that's one point of attack. The other one is one that Apple doesn't entirely control, and that is the connection between me and Apple. So I'm sitting here and I have my computer and I'm syncing my device, or it's going over the air to my wireless carrier. They are one link. Then they link to other internet carriers, so-called backbone carriers that you and I never even see. And they link to other backbone carriers and they link to Apple. Every one of those is another potential point of attack. I can't control them. I don't have any knowledge even which ones are being used. Neither does Apple. In the middle there is this unmanaged thing, which is the internet. And that's how it's designed, but that's also its Achilles heel sometimes on security.
So what kind of security steps does Apple take to make sure that that content is protected?
I would assume, and most importantly, we don't really know, because that's the first step in good security, is not to tell the world what you're doing. But we can assume that Apple, being one of the most sophisticated technology companies in the world, has thrown massive resources at this, not just because it's the right thing to do, but because it's important for their position in the market and their fiscal health to not have this be hacked. No one has more resources than Apple. Yet, just look at the Sony story over the last couple of weeks. There's a big company with all the technology resources money can buy and supposedly enough sense to use them, but has had massive intrusions, and they're far from the first.
Are there certain things that consumers can do if they plan on using the cloud system to protect their data?
First thing is, think about the security you're using, your password. A lot of people are very sloppy about their passwords, and the first step in good cloud security is to have a hard-to-figure-out password that you change regularly, every 6 months at least. Now, what we're seeing since iCloud announced is a renewed call in the security community for another step, and that's called two-part authentication. Right now, when you log in with a password, that's one part. You're just using one key, if you will, to open that lock. Two-part means you need two keys for every lock, a password and something else that's even harder to fake, like a fingerprint scan, an iris scan, or what they call a token dongle. This was part of the story.
A token dongle?
Yeah, it's a thing that is used by government and enterprise security, high-end corporate stuff. There was a big story about this in the last few days. A company called RSA issues these, 40 million of them they've issued, to various corporate computer users and government and defense. And they look at this little device when they log in, and it has a number that's changing all the time. They enter that and their password to get logged in. But it was in the news last week because even that has been breached. So it's a cat and mouse game here. The part that you can do, though, is to really maintain good password practices.
Brian Cooley, always good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Michelle.
Brian Cooley is the editor-at-large with the online tech magazine CNET. He was talking to us about Apple's iCloud service and security.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow, trying to overcome a bout of laryngitis, so see if you can hang in there with me for this program. Our current ideas about the universe say that when the universe was created in the Big Bang billions of years ago, not only was matter created, but so was matter's mirror image, antimatter. One of the great mysteries about the universe is, where did all the antimatter go? How come we don't see it anymore? And if you want to see it to study it, we have to create it in the laboratory. But when we do, it only lasts, so exists for a fraction of a second. Until now. Last November, researchers created and trapped antihydrogen, the simplest atom of antimatter, holding it in a magnetized bottle for only a fraction of a second. And now that same team is back and they've raised the bar, trapping antimatter for longer than ever before. This antihydrogen, around 16 minutes, just about as long as they wanted. So now, what do you do with it? Here to answer that question is Dr. Jeffrey Hengst. He's professor of physics at Aarhus University in Denmark. He's also the leader of the Alpha Collaboration at CERN in Geneva. Welcome back, Dr. Hengst.
Thank you, Ira. It's good to be back. I must be doing something right.
Well, what you've done is you've trapped antimatter for longer, for what, 16 minutes?
Yeah, a 1,000 seconds is 16 minutes, give or take.
And could you have gone as long as you wanted to?
Well, we don't really know the limit yet. This was as long as we conducted the experiment and could get statistics enough to see the signal. This takes some time, of course, and we've seen some events at longer time, but we can't say 100% certain that they're above the background. So 1,000 seconds is firmly established, and we can continue to look for longer, but it's not our highest priority right now.
Talk about antihydrogen. How is it different than regular hydrogen?
Well, that's what we'd like to know. We'd like to measure the characteristics of antihydrogen and see if it's the same as hydrogen. The fundamental difference is, of course, that antihydrogen is made of antiparticles. So instead of a positive proton, you have a negative antiproton. Instead of an electron in hydrogen, you have a positron, an anti-electron. So that's the structure of the thing. The question is whether this thing obeys the same laws of physics as normal hydrogen. And that's what we're finally getting ready to measure.
Well, the fact that you were able to trap it in a magnetized bottle would not tell you something.
Well, the fact that we can trap it doesn't tell us too much yet. We need to take the next step, which is to shine light on it, both literally and figuratively. We'd like to interact with it, with its internal structure, to see what kind of color of light does it like to absorb, or what frequency of microwaves, for example, because we know those things very well for hydrogen. So the next thing, and the thing that many of us have been working for a long time, is to measure something about this thing.
Do the antiparticles conform to the other, for lack of better phraseology, laws of nature, like the regular particles, like gravitation, magnetism, things like that?
We know absolutely nothing about gravitation and antimatter as far as measurements are concerned. In fact, that's one of the exciting things about this new development, is that having them around for a while may allow us to do what we need to do to them to study their gravitational influence in the Earth's gravitational field. It's a very special experiment, antimatter in a matter gravitational field. We've never tried that before. It's an extremely difficult experiment. But more fundamentally, okay, we know that the antiproton has a charge that's very close to the proton, and that the positron has a charge that's very close to that of the electron in magnitude. They're opposite, of course. But we haven't been able to study a composite antimatter system like this with any kind of real precision. And that's what we'd like to do, because hydrogen is something we really understand very well in physics. So if we can do the same sort of things with antihydrogen, we can compare them.
And it's the most abundant element in the universe.
Hydrogen is, yes. Yeah. And antihydrogen is the least abundant element in the universe.
So where did it all go?
That's the question. You know, in physics, we like to think big. The paleontologists are missing a few dinosaurs and fossils along the way. We've misplaced half the universe, and we really don't know what happened to it. So as you pointed out, the Big Bang theory says that there should have been equal amounts of matter and antimatter at the beginning of the universe. And for some reason, only the matter survived. Of course, they can't be in the same place at the same time. We can't have both. But why couldn't we have an antimatter universe? That, as far as we understand today, that should have been equally probable. So we just don't know why nature chose one and not the other.
Hmm. And the first thing you'll be doing then is, if now that you've trapped it in the bottle, you say you would shine some laser light on it?
The first thing we'll actually do is microwaves.
Microwave. Well,
you can think of these little atoms as magnets. They're trapped because they have a little magnetic moment, as we call it. They're like a small bar magnet. And that's trapped in this magnetic field. If you shine some microwaves of the right frequency on that atom, you can turn its magnet the other direction. And then it'll fall out of this trap and annihilate. And we can see that. Even just a single atom, if it comes out, we can detect it. So there, antimatter gives you kind of a detection bonus. It's easier to detect than matter when it annihilates. So that's what we'll do. We'll shine some microwaves on it and see if it likes the same frequencies that hydrogen would like. That would be the first test of this sort of symmetry between hydrogen and antihydrogen. It's not the most precise one, but it's a first step.
Mm-hmm. Some questions coming in from our listeners. On our Science Friday Facebook page, Daniel Yout would like to know about whether the antihydrogen could be the start of a new periodic table.
Well, that's an excellent question. In fact, it's a timely question, because very recently in the Brookhaven National Laboratory at the Rick Accelerator, a group created anti-helium nuclei in collisions of very heavy ions. But that's very, very difficult, and they don't produce them in a way that you could catch them. They just demonstrated that anti-helium nuclei, that's number two on the anti-periodic table, that they exist. But there's really no chance of doing what we do to make an anti-helium atom. So these things just existed a little bit in a collision and then ran into some material. So it's very, very, very unlikely. I'd say impossible to make anti-helium atoms and try to study them.
But you could make a new periodic table. We make these little, high-level particles that last for a fraction of a second. Wouldn't you have to start?
That's right. In we believe that there is an anti-periodic table, right? That you could have an anti-universe full of anti-elements. But it's very difficult for us to go and do atomic physics on those. So you can demonstrate so far that we've got two of them.
And how difficult is it to go up then and create new elements, anti-elements?
Well, we say it the Brookhaven paper, it takes about a factor of 1,000 every time you want to add one mass. So going from hydrogen to deuterium, right, that's a proton and a neutron, you'll get 1,000 times less deuterons for the same type of interaction. So that's 1,000 for every one. So you can see it gets really, really unlikely very quickly to get anything heavier. So I think you can just forget that and hope that we can find something with antihydrogen.
Let's go to the phones. David in St. Louis. Hi, welcome.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering, you talk about the annihilation when the matter meets the antimatter, and I was reading about this week, and I was wondering, does this interaction obey the laws that we think of, like the conservation of mass and energy? Like in a nuclear reaction, you'll lose mass, but you'll gain energy. What happens when these two, what exactly do you mean by annihilation? Thanks.
Yeah, that's a good question. What happens exactly is that the quarks in the antiproton annihilate with quarks in a nucleus in the material. And that produces energy for just a very fleeting moment. And what happens in practice is that energy quickly becomes mass again. So that's Einstein, E equals mc squared. This energy that goes into the annihilation quickly generates new mass. And this mass is in the form of subatomic particles we call pions. And they come screaming out of our apparatus, and we can measure them. So as far as we know, these annihilation events obey conservation of mass and energy. Mm-hmm. And no one's ever seen any kind of deviation from that. But the energy quickly becomes mass that flies out, and we can measure.
And now that you've proven you can hold on to these particles long enough to get a good look at them, after you do your microwave experiment, what's the next? Is there a better detector you're working on?
No, the next thing, you want to keep making more and more precise measurements, right? The thing about atomic physics is atomic physicists are the guys who really know how to measure things precisely. So, for example, the energy of the 1-2 transition, we call it in hydrogen, from the ground state to the first excited state, is known to 1 part in 10^14, approximately. Right? That's 0.014 zeros, 1 in precision. So in order to do the best test, you'd like to repeat that experiment in antihydrogen. And that requires lasers, a very special laser system. So starting next year, we hope, we'll be able to shine lasers on the antihydrogen that's in the trap and start seeing that it wants exactly the same color as hydrogen. That's a figuratively color because the light that we're going to use is invisible.
Mm-hmm. And one last question. About a minute that we have left, to see as many questions as I can get in. How do you make antimatter?
Well, this again, it's all up to Einstein. CERN uses energy from a particle accelerator to create new things, right? That's what they're looking for when they're searching for the Higgs boson. They're using a very high-energy particle accelerator to create some new mass, E equals mc squared. You have to do the same thing to make an antiproton. We use energy at a particle accelerator. It's a lower energy than the LHC, but we need the energy to create the mass in the antiproton. And, of course, we create proton-antiproton pairs. That's what the law tells us. But they're made in an accelerator, and that's why we have to be at CERN to make the antiprotons. Turns out you can buy positrons. You can get a radioactive source that's made, in this case, in South Africa, that just sits and emits positrons all day long. And then we have a device that accumulates them and stores them up.
Ah, quite interesting. I wish you good luck in
Thank
your
you.
Experiment.
Hope to be back soon.
Yeah, tell us when you do that gravity laser experiment. Or
yeah, okay.
Get it close to a good. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Dr. Jeffrey Hanks, Professor of Physics at Aarhus University in Denmark.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. Imagine if you could use your cell phone or send an email from anywhere. Well, one company is working hard to make out of range a thing of the past, providing internet access with satellites and a network of 40,000 antennas. But GPS advocates say the new service would interfere with their devices. As NPR's Brian Naylor reports, they worry the service could make it harder for first responders to find emergencies, for aviators to fly, and for drivers to navigate.
Continue 0.1 miles, then turn right on Pennsylvania Avenue Northwest.
The GPS device has become ubiquitous. Millions of drivers rely on them for directions. GPS navigation is the basis for a new air traffic control system the government plans to build. It's also an important tool in agriculture. Rick Richter is owner of Richter Aviation in Maxwell, California, flying what used to be known as crop dusters. He uses GPS every day.
It provides our swath guidance to within 1 meter accuracy of where we
would like to put the chemicals or the crop protection products or the seeds or fertilizers. So it allows for precise application of our products.
Richter is president of the National Agricultural Aviation Association. It's one of several groups that want to put the brakes on construction of a new broadband service by a company called LightSquared. In a video on its website, LightSquared offers an enticing vision.
Wireless devices will work in every single part of the country. People will be able to send email from the Grand Canyon. Download a full-length movie in mere minutes while on the move. Make a phone call far away from anywheresville.
The problem, says Richter, the radio signals the broadband carrier wants to use for its wireless network interfere with signals used by GPS.
There's no doubt there's going to be interference. You can almost guarantee that because that signal is so much more powerful than a GPS signal.
In fact, the government's own tests have shown the LightSquared signals cause some GPS receivers to lose strength and they block out others entirely. This has caused both the Defense Department and the Department of Homeland Security to raise questions. That's because the part of the radio spectrum which the FCC granted to LightSquared is right next door to the part of the spectrum used by GPS. Communications consultant Scott Cleland says it's a bit like a zoning dispute,
where people that already have houses or they already have buildings, and somebody comes along next to them and wants to build a skyscraper or wants to build something that has a very different use than what they had before. And so what this is like a giant spectrum zoning spat.
LightSquared, the new guy in the neighborhood, has already invested billions of dollars in its network. Based on the FCC's go-ahead, it launched a 7-story-tall satellite last November and plans to build some 40,000 ground transmitters. Company Vice President Jeff Carlisle is confident the two sides can work something out.
We still want to make sure that we're deploying our network responsibly. And that requires us to sit down cooperatively and talk with the GPS folks and figure out the most efficient and fair way to do it. If that requires some filtering on their side and some transmission modifications on ours, we're open to talking about that. Absolutely.
One possible solution would be for LightSquared to use the part of the spectrum they've been allocated that's farthest from the part GPS receivers use. The company had hoped to roll out its network later this year, but facing concerns from government agencies and competing businesses, it's clear they've got some obstacles to navigate around first. Brian Naylor, NPR News, Washington.